So I would like to disclose that I do serve as a consultant for Prima Temp. I will not be discussing Prima Temp products today. But the objectives for my talk today is, hopefully at the end of this talk, you'll better understand the impact of female aging on oocyte quality and quantity. You'll be better able to counsel women about the meaning or what clinical implications of an ovarian reserve test such as AMH, and explore the potential use of AMH as a marker of PCOS if we have adequate time. As Forrest Gump once said, oocytes are like a box of chocolates. Okay. I like that movie a lot. So oocytes are like a box of chocolates. Over time, there are fewer and fewer chocolates. That's our quantity. And these chocolates remaining become stale, or the quality. So evidence of this is supported here by the CDC data on ART success rates by age. These are pretty old data, from 2010. And luckily, the curve has shifted upward. But the shape of the curve is still the same, in that we see that IVF success rates, meaning pregnancy rates following IVF, are pretty stable until around the mid-30s. Classically, we say that magical age of 35, right? And then slowly decline, such that at about age 40, the IVF success rates are about half of that for women less than 35 years of age. Now, this is seen in IVF pregnancies, but what about naturally conceived pregnancies? This is data from a study called Time to Conceive, which I'll be discussing later. But basically, in this on this graphic, you'll see on the x-axis the age of the woman when she started trying to get pregnant, and on the y-axis the probability of getting pregnant by 12 cycles, or assuming a year of attempt to conceive. For this graph, we did present the data both as women that had a prior conception and for women that had not had a prior conception. And basically, similar to what you see with IVF data, the pregnancy rates, at least in those women that have had a prior pregnancy, are pretty stable until age 35, and then we see a subsequent decline, such that about age 40, the pregnancy rates after a year are about half that of women less than age 35. I always think it's interesting, though, to compare the graphic for women that have had a prior conception versus women that have not had a prior conception. I don't think there's anything that's really saving women, helping their fertility by having a baby, but it's more that we know all the plumbing's working and the sperm is good, and that's what differentiates these two curves. And that really this is the best marker of kind of oocyte aging, because we know everything in this woman is already functioning. So why is this, of course, and this is data from Jason Farnesiak in Fertility Sterility back in 2014, and this is a nice study looking at results of pre-implantation genetic testing for aneuploidy. Basically, they looked at the rates of aneuploidy on embryo after embryo biopsy by a woman's age. And here at the top, you see the percentage of embryos which are aneuploid. And then you on the x-axis, you see the woman's age. And just as we saw with pregnancy rates, if you look at embryo aneuploidy, you see that the rates are relatively stable until around age 35, and then we see an increase in aneuploidy, such that I'm always impressed, around 44, 45, about 90% of embryos are chromosomally abnormal. The other thing that I personally always find this frightening in my patients, too, is how inefficient a species we are, in the sense that even at our most reproductive ages, 30% of our embryos are chromosomally abnormal. This, of course, results not only in lower pregnancy rates, but also in higher rates of miscarriage. And this is data, much older data, but it's been replicated by Anderson et al., and really showing miscarriage rates by a woman's age. And once again, we see that kind of steady state of miscarriage rates until at age 35, and then the gradual increase in risk of miscarriage. So from this, I think we can pretty much conclude that age is the best marker of egg quality, or the probability of conceiving and or having a euploid embryo conceiving and then not miscarrying, and that we really don't have a way to stop the decline in egg quality. And I would say age right now is the only marker that we have regarding egg quality. But you're here to talk about, hear more about biomarkers of reproductive potential. You've known for forever that age was a predictor. So we're going to shift talk to talking a little bit more about oocyte quantity. So this is work done by Carl Hansen and Latasha Craig, two of my heroes, who did some great work back in the 20 or early 2000s, and basically were looking at, they would enroll women in a study who were going to undergo a planned THBSO. And prior to THBSO, they'd obtain blood serum from the women, a medical history, and then at the same time, at the time of their hysterectomy, they'd actually take an ovary and slice it up and then count the number of primordial follicles, or how many oocytes the woman has remaining. So this is data from that study, and let me go back here. And what you see on the x-axis here is age once again, and on the y-axis is basically a logarithmic version of primordial follicle number. And as you see, and this is, you know, true looking at the actual ovary, as a woman ages, the number of primordial follicles declines. Well, we can't take out women's ovaries and measure the number of follicles and then expect her to reproduce. That's awfully difficult. So some interesting thing is we can look at potential biomarkers or look at markers of the decline in oocyte quantity. So we've got the ovary that's aging, we're losing eggs, and we know from that we also see a decline in AMH. At the same time, a woman has a decline in inhibin B, which results in an early follicular phase rise in FSH and premature follicular development. Such that actually, as women age and their number of follicles or ovarian reserves start to decline, we see a shortening in the follicular phase length, with classically describing a standard still, the luteal phase remaining the standard 14 days. So overall, the menstrual length shortens. And the very interesting thing about this is that actually, this is actually a marker of reproductive potential. So Broden et al. Looked at menstrual cycle length and the probability of conceiving following in vitro fertilization, and it very interestingly showed that women with longer menstrual cycle lengths were more likely to conceive in an IVF cycle. So even menstrual cycle length itself, meaning her historical menstrual cycle length, was a predictor of the probability of conceiving following in vitro. Then we looked at this not also in naturally conceived pregnancies. This is data from the SNART-GRAVID study and from Time to Conceive, and the two graphics are pretty similar. You see menstrual cycle length here on the x-axis, and then the probability of conceiving in a given natural menstrual cycle. And what I think is very fascinating is not as much the top end here, but really this lower end where you see short menstrual cycle lengths are associated with reduced fecundability. So even menstrual cycle length may be a biomarker of reproductive potential. But we're here today to talk about serum markers. And so we're going to focus right now on AMH. So what is AMH? I like to tell my patients it wasn't put on this planet for us to measure their ovarian reserve. It actually has a purpose in our bodies, at least in women. Well, it is a glycoprotein, and it's produced by the granulosa cells in preantral and early antral follicles. And basically, the purpose of AMH is to inhibit recruitment of the primary follicles from the primordial pool, meaning you don't want all of that primordial pool being activated so that you're now a woman's ovulating multiple follicles and having a litter, right? So it, or that a woman is using up of her, all of her oocytes early on. So AMH kind of inhibits this follicular development at earlier stages. And as I mentioned, it progressively reduces responsiveness of developing follicles to FSH. So looking back again at Dr. Hansen and Dr. Craig's work, where they looked at the number of primordial follicles in the ovary, and they actually measured the woman's AMH value before she had her ovary removed. And they, this study here now, they're showing AMH on the x-axis, and then the number of primordial follicles on the y-axis. And basically what you're seeing here is when the AMH level is higher, there are more primordial follicles. And when the AMH is low, there are truly fewer follicles or eggs remaining in the ovary. So this is proof that AMH is a marker of ovarian reserve. So given that we know that AMH is lower in, or given the fact that we know that ovarian reserve is lower in higher ages and that AMH is a marker of ovarian reserve, we can therefore look at AMH and kind of tell a patient what her ovarian reserve is compared to women her same age, okay? So we wouldn't expect a woman in her early 20s to have the same AMH value as a woman in her 40s. That just doesn't, that wouldn't be normal, right? So there's this nice figure in this article in by Dolman et al. In JCM, which I like to pull out all the time when a patient gets an AMH value back and try to tell her how her ovarian reserve compares to another woman her same age. For example, here we've got, I just want to show you, x-axis is age again, y-axis is her AMH value, and each one of these curves represents a percentile for her age group. So here they've got the little nice convenient x written here around age 40, and this woman had an AMH value of 1 at age 40. And this would place her basically around the 50th percentile, or the median, for ovarian reserve. So half of women her age would have more eggs, and half of women her age would have fewer eggs. And this I find very helpful, just trying to tell that patient what her AMH value means, because there's nothing worse than you get the AMH and you don't know how to explain it to her, and all you have is that normal range. But certainly you wouldn't expect, as I mentioned, a normal range to be the same for a 20-year-old as opposed to a 40-year-old. So I really like this graphic, and if you're looking one, that's where you can find it for educating your patients. But we want to focus now on the evidence out there that these markers could be predictors of a woman's reproductive potential. So we're going to focus again on oocyte quantity, because that's what these biomarkers represent. And basically the concept here is that, yes, as a woman's aging, she's moving through the stages of reproductive aging, and at the same time, the oocyte quantity is declining, so maybe these biomarkers of oocyte quantity are going to be a marker of her reproductive potential. You'll recall a number of years ago we had this thing called the Straw criteria, which basically broke down, kind of differentiated women into different stages of reproductive aging, with there being a reproductive stage with an early peak and late, a perimenopausal transition with an early and late, and these were differentiated based on kind of menstrual cycle characteristics, the early being represented by kind of a shortening of the menstrual cycle length, And then the late perimenopausal being once a woman starts kind of missing periods. So we kind of classified women by stages of reproductive aging, and the idea was, can we now predict what stage a woman is in, not by her menstrual cycle characteristics, but by these ovarian reserve tests? And once again, Dr. Hansen decided to look at this. So could the AMH value predict, or other biomarkers, could that predict a stage that a woman is in regarding her stage of reproductive aging? So I'll have you focus here on the E graphic, because we'll be talking mainly today about AMH. And here you see the straw stages. So -4 is peak reproductive, -3 is late reproductive, -2 is early perimenopausal, and -1 is late perimenopausal. And what Dr. Hansen and his group did show is that when women are in their peak reproductive ages, AMH levels are much higher. However, compared to when they're in their late reproductive age, in the early perimenopausal transition, and then in the late perimenopausal transition. And we do have evidence that AMH is a marker of menopause. So AMH, levels are associated with age of menopause. There's been some nice work done by using in the Penn Ovarian Aging Study and by Sowers et al., showing that AMH levels are associated with AMH and menopause. But unfortunately, they're not very good predictors of the actual age at menopause, meaning that they did this study and they looked at women with an AMH value of less than 0.2 that were between 45 and 48 years of age. They had more, on average, went through menopause in 6 years. Whereas a woman with an AMH value of less than 0.2, but between the ages of 35 and 39, went through menopause on average 10 years later. So it's not a great predictor of the exact age that a woman's going to go through menopause, although AMH is associated. And then they also found that in the Cardia study that over 60% of women with an undetectable AMH aged 45 to 49 entered menopause within 5 years. That meant 40% of women with an undetectable AMH did not enter menopause within the next 5 years. And when you're looking at kind of predicting the actual age in menopause, the prediction intervals that are out there are very broad. In other words, kind of when they would predict a woman's age at menopause, they'd give a wide range, anywhere between 48 and 55. And another study predicted ages between, let's say, 42 and 55. And I don't know about you, but if I said to a woman, you're going to go through menopause between age 48 and 55, I don't think she's going to think I'm telling her anything very miraculous, or I'm not going to get my fee from that, or even 42 to 55, that's a pretty broad interval. So we do know that AMH is associated with age at menopause, but it's not a very good predictor, meaning you can't use it to say this is the age that you're going to go through menopause. And why is this? And forgive me, this is going to be a little complicated, but I'll try to walk you through it, because it's really great work that was done by Ducat et al. And they wanted to see, look at this, try to look into that factor, like, when you get an AMH value and it's low, you have this fear, and your patient has this fear that tomorrow she's going to go into menopause, right? And so they wanted to kind of look at trajectories of AMH in relation to age at menopause. So the first thing we're going to look at this is figure A, and you've got age on the x-axis, and on the y-axis you have her AMH. And they've broken every woman, they've kind of created different categories or figure lines for women that were in the highest quartile of AMH for their age. So they measured AMH in all these women initially, and then they broke them up into quartiles of AMH by age. So these women had were in the lowest quartile of AMH, or had the lowest ovarian reserve for their given age. And these had the highest. And then they looked at their AMH by age. So they followed them over time and looked at it. So the fascinating thing is, first of all, if you look at this curve, those with the lowest AMH or in the lowest quartile, those curves look much different from the women with the highest, with the normal or the highest quartiles. In fact, if you almost say their AMH goes up, we know that probably doesn't happen, but that's not like they're getting more eggs over time, but really we know that they're not having the same kind of decline. So theirs is a much broader, if you look at this time period, it's kind of staying, they're still lower than everybody else, but certainly it doesn't have this increased slope that you see. The rate of decline is much slower in this AMH, in the group that had the lowest AMH. So probably the women that are in the lowest quartile, that have the lowest ovarian reserve, they've been low all their life. So they kind of have the low, they just compared to everybody else, they always have this lower ovarian reserve, but they're not, and they may go through menopause a little bit earlier, but they're not probably on that cliff about to fall off. And so the problem is that when we get an AMH value, we're looking at one time point. So let's say we look at a time point and we measure an AMH of 0.5. Well, if the woman is in the low AMH category, that means she's still got 10 more years to go before she's going to go through menopause. But if she was actually in that higher quartile and we check 0.5, now that woman is going to go through menopause in 5 years. So this is a little hard to kind of differentiate if you're getting one point in time, whether or not a woman is simply in this lower group who always is going to have a low ovarian reserve, or is this woman that is rapidly on the decline. And that's why AMH is not a good predictor of the actual age a woman is going to go through menopause. Okay, so forgive that little digression there. But what does AMH tell us? And we do know, every REI knows here, that AMH is a great predictor of your oocyte yield, meaning the higher AMH, more eggs you are going to get. And once again, AMH on the x-axis and the number of oocytes collected at the time of retrieval following controlled ovarian hyperstimulation. You'll have to forgive, this is a European study, so it's in picomoles per liter, but you get the drift that as AMH increases, the number of eggs retrieved also increases. But what about predicting the chances of a woman getting pregnant naturally? So can AMH be used as that magical fertility test? Because age is not good enough, right? I may be this age, but what is my fertility compared to my friend who's the same age? We want something to differentiate us from everybody else our age. And so there have been a number of studies trying to tease this out. We actually did a small pilot study in which we enrolled 100 women who were trying to get pregnant between the ages of 30 and 44 years of age. And in this pilot study, it did suggest that women with lower AMH were less likely to get pregnant. There was a Danish study studying, looking at much younger women and also suggested that women with higher or lower AMH were also less likely to get pregnant, but it was not statistically significant. But then a secondary analysis of the EAGER trial suggested that there was no association between AMH and the probability of conceiving naturally. So we went on to conduct a cohort study called Time to Conceive, which was funded very nicely by your tax dollars and the NIH. And this was a prospective time to pregnancy cohort study in which we enrolled women ages 30 to 44 years of age who had been trying to conceive naturally for 3 or fewer months and were heterosexual and cohabitating with their partner. They could not have any history of infertility because we felt like if they knew they were infertile, they had been infertile before, they probably didn't need a test to see if they were infertile. They were also excluded if they had a diagnosis of endometriosis, PCOS, or a history of pelvic inflammatory disease. or a partner with history of infertility or plans to use therapeutic insemination to conceive. So basically, we enrolled them right when they started trying to get pregnant. We got a blood sample and urine sample from them and followed them from enrollment until early pregnancy or until they had been trying to conceive for 12 months. So this is kind of how the study ended up working. We had 981 women that were enrolled in time to conceive, 142 women conceived before we could actually get blood from them. So that makes it a little hard to study them. And then a number of them failed to show up for their study visit. So we ended up with 770 serum samples and a study visit. Unfortunately, we couldn't figure out how long they'd been trying to get pregnant, and about seven women, it was just implausible information or data, and we had no follow-up on 13. So we ended up with a total of 750 women that we could analyze in this cohort study. And this is what we found. Once again, let me walk you through this graphic here. X-axis is their attempt cycle. So this would be the first cycle they tried to get pregnant. Not the first cycle they enrolled in the study, but the first attempt cycle, the second attempt cycle, third, fourth, and all the way up to the 12th attempt cycle. So we actually did look at menstrual cycles. We didn't look at time. And that's just because we had actual information on menstrual cycles. And then this is the cumulative probability of conceiving. So this is a classic time to pregnancy curve. And as you would expect, is as time goes on, the cumulative pregnancy would go up, okay? So, and then what you have here are different curves based on their initial AMH value. Now, I should tell you, we didn't even measure the AMH level until the women were done with the study. So we had it sitting in the freezer. We didn't want anybody tempted to look at their AMH value because you knew if the woman knew her AMH value, it was all she was going to run to a fertility clinic. So we couldn't have that kind of differentiating it. So all of these were retrospective, meaning we had the sample, but we found out the results of their actually AMH after the trial had concluded. So the yellow curve here are the group that had low AMH. Now that we defined that as being less than 0.7. Now we can debate all day long about what cutoff for AMH you want to use, but this is what we decided to go with. A normal AMH we called between 0.7 and 8.5. Now, what's normal AMH? We go on forever about that. And what's your upper limit is normal. But this was our upper 90th percentile. So women that had over, there were 10% of women that had an AMH value of greater than 8.5. So that's who we put in as the high AMH. And basically, if you look at this, the women in the low AMH did not have different curves compared to the women with the normal or the high AMH. So these curves, especially their 95% confidence intervals, overlap. And what the main thing I think is important to take home is what we would have expected if AMH was going to predict your probability of conceiving naturally, we would expect this curve to be lower, right? We would expect this yellow curve to be way down here, that they were slower to get pregnant and that the cumulative pregnancy rate at the end of 12 months would have been lower. But in actuality, if you look at the probability of conceiving after six cycles of attempt, whether or not you had an AMH of less than 0.7, normal range or high range, pretty much all of these pregnancy rates, predicted pregnancy rates, at six cycles were the same. Okay? And also you could see the same results if you looked at 12 cycles of attempt. Meaning, although this looked like slightly different numbers, with the highest AMH being less likely to conceive by 12 cycles of attempt, all of these confidence intervals do overlap. I should say that all of these were adjusted for age, because, of course, age is an excellent predictor of AMH. And if you don't adjust for age, you're really just, in these studies, you're really just seeing the age effect. So these are all adjusted for age. So What can we conclude from this? What is the clinical value of AMH? Well, number one, Dr. Hansen's group proved it is a measure of ovarian reserve. And you can talk to women and say how their ovarian reserve compares with other women their age. It's an excellent predictor of response to stimulation following COH and oocyte yield at the time of retrieval. It is associated with age at menopause, but please don't use it to try to predict the age a woman's going to go through menopause unless you give that really broad range. And it clearly is not a predictor of reproductive potential. So regarding AMH testing, I highly recommend using it or using this test in women with unproven reproductive potential. We're not talking about women with infertility. We're talking about the woman that walks in and says she wants that fertility test and has never tried to get pregnant. It's going to induce unnecessary anxiety because a young woman with a low AMH is going to be very nervous and think she's going to have difficulties getting pregnant, which we know this is not true. And it's going to potentially induce false reassurance in the older woman with a high AMH, because she's going to say to you, oh, good, I don't have to do anything. My AMH looks great. But she still doesn't escape that age-related decline in fertility. She may have more eggs at age 40, but they're still the same stale as the box of chocolates scenario, stale eggs as another 40-year-old. And really, this should not be used as a decision aid as far as to determine whether or not a woman should freeze her eggs or not freeze her eggs.